From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Illinois Senator Roland Burris may not have told the whole truth and nothing but the truth about his relationship with ousted Governor Rod Blagojevich, and now he is under investigation. And President Obama signs his $787 billion recovery package. Now he sets his sights on fixing the housing crisis with a plan to forestall home foreclosures. He's also ordering a 50% boost in troop levels in Afghanistan. Here to discuss these political developments, we have Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She is an author and a nationally syndicated columnist. And Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post. Robert, Donna, nice to have you back.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be here. Hey, Donna.
Thank you, Tony. Hello, Robert.
So the junior senator from Illinois, Roland Burris, is back in the headlines. Did he raise money or not for Governor Blagojevich in exchange for becoming the next senator from the land of Lincoln? And did he lie about it under oath? That is the question, but getting the answer, Donna Brazile, seems especially tricky. Why do the Democrats keep doing this? I mean, not vetting people fully. Burris's story seems to change every day.
I'm embarrassed by this situation. Roland Burris is a man of integrity. I've known Senator Burris for many, many years, and this conflicting daily change of stories clearly has put Mr. Burris in some hot water with his colleagues. As you know, the Senate Ethics Committee has opened up a preliminary inquiry into the matter. There's, of course, folks in Illinois, including his hometown paper, the Chicago Tribune. They've called for the senator to resign. The Washington Post, of course, called for him to resign. I think that Senator Burris needs to sit in a room with his attorney or attorneys and come up with a credible story and an explanation and go before the Ethics Committee and explain his contact with former Governor Blagojevich, his brother, whether or not he had, decided to be a part of some scheme to raise money for the governor. I think he owes the people of Illinois a full explanation, an honest account of what happened. Remember, there are tapes.
That's true.
He may be on tape.
Yeah, he may be on tape. Well, you know, you mentioned that the GOP is calling for him to resign. Even Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Robert, is lukewarm. Here's my question for you, though. What is the strategy that the Republicans should take on this? Keep hammering to get him out or let this fester as a sore on the Democrats?
I think if I was giving any advice to Republicans, which I'm certainly not, I would just let this play out right now. You've had a couple of the hometown Republicans say that he should resign, so they've put their marker down on it. As for Republicans in the Senate, just let it play out, because keep in mind, Reid and the Democratic leadership didn't want Burris in originally because they figured anybody that Blagojevich was putting in was going to be tainted. Then they basically got pushed into it when it looked like they were being like the white guys keeping the black guy out of the club, and so they approved him. And now this, of course, is completely blowing up in their face. So as far as Republicans go, it ends up being a win if he ends up resigning, because it's going to be an embarrassment to the Senate. Unfortunately, it's going to also be an embarrassment to President Obama, who obviously has had his own issues with people withdrawing over ethical and tax issues within his own candidate.
Within his own cabinet.
So even though he had nothing to do with this, it's going to look like part of the same. And so I think the Republicans can just basically let this play out and say, the Democrats and the president have problems vetting people for significant places, and the Republicans back in Illinois, I think at this point, are going to have a head start on the 2010 election.
Well, you make some really interesting points. One more thing I want to talk about with regard to this story before we move on to the next topic, Donna, is this, that you are a Democratic strategist. The votes in the Senate are very key, as we've already found out with the stimulus package voting between the Republicans and the Democrats. What would you advise President Obama to do about this guy from his home state?
Well, this matter is now before the United States Senate. As you all know, the legislative and executive branches of government are co-equal branches, and I think that if the Senate has opened up a preliminary inquiry, they should complete their task. Mr. Burris should comply with whatever information that they deem necessary to decide whether or not he should remain in the United States Senate. You know, they could censor him, they can remove him, but I think at this point, before we rush to judgment, we should give Senator Burris an opportunity to give the United States Senate Ethics Committee a full explanation. And I don't believe President Obama should in any way involve himself now that this matter has gone before the Ethics Committee.
I will say this, though,
Donna. Make it brief, because we've got to move on.
The fact that your advice to him was, you know, he needs to sit down with his lawyers in a room and figure out what his story is. I think once if you're a senator and you're discussing with your lawyers about what you need to say, I think you've already lost the plot.
Well, you may be right about that. Let's move on to another topic, because with the ink on the stimulus package still drying, the president has unveiled another plan, this time to tackle the foreclosure crisis. Now, from my initial reading, some of its provisions and from what some Republicans, Robert, have been saying about the importance of saving the housing industry, Lindsey Graham comes to mind as just one, this could be a strategy that garners more bipartisan support, couldn't it?
I think you're right. I think we've had just one bailout too many. But right now, since we're pouring all this money in, I guess everybody has to get their own little bit. But you're right. I mean, I think it was Senator Kyle from Arizona who's a very conservative senator. But he basically talked about the need for assistance on the mortgage side, because Arizona, along with California, Florida, they're some of the states that have been really hit the hardest. I do believe that even though many Republicans are very wary about all this money going out, all this bailout, because of the foreclosures, the situations, and because it's hitting senior citizens as well as regular middle class voters, that you are gonna get not a whole lot, but a considerable number.
More than three.
More than three Republicans will be working with the president on this.
Yes. Now, Donna, the president also seems to be taking a slightly more direct strategic approach to selling this particular plan. He's going directly to the people, isn't he?
I think he should. If Congress is not prepared to help honest, hardworking, taxpaying Americans who many of them qualify for conventional loans, but they were so subprime, predatory loans. More than 2.3 million homeowners coast to coast are faced with foreclosure. That's an 81% increase. And I think we need to figure out a way to lower the monthly payments so that these borrowers can stay in their homes, maintain their payments. And the president is doing the right thing and taking his case to the American people. And this shouldn't be a partisan issue. This should be an issue where both sides can get in the room and figure out the best way to help these homeowners.
Now, here's my final point with you guys. Let's talk about the foreign policy for just a moment. This is the last topic of today's reporter's political roundtable. The president's foreign policy agenda coming a little more clearly into view with his making good on his campaign promise to focus the country's military effort now on Afghanistan. He's ordered 17,000 additional troops there. Campaign promises are one thing, but the reality on the ground between Pakistan and Afghanistan is another. How risky is this first big military move, both for the country and for Obama, Robert?
I think it's pretty risky. As history has told us, Afghanistan and Iraq are two very, very different countries. A number of empires have ended up dying or coming to an end in Afghanistan because of the geography and the terrain and so forth. And I would think, obviously I'm not on the left, but it seems to me some of Obama's supporters on the left are going to have to be a little bit uncomfortable about the fact that he hasn't really come forward with any plan to announce his withdrawal from Iraq yet, and already he's sending 17,000 more troops into Afghanistan, which if you add up to the 150,000 that are still in Iraq, Obama is basically going to be overseeing more American troops in combat theaters than George W. Bush did. So it's been a little bit ironic there.
Let me give you the last word on this. I've got about 40 seconds for your answer, Donna. What do you think? Risky or not?
The increase, as President Obama said, is necessary to stabilize a deteriorating situation in Afghanistan. The president believes that this has not received the strategic attention. He said that we cannot solve this problem with the military alone. The Taliban has reorganized itself. He talked about diplomacy, development, and he said that he takes full responsibility. He's mindful of the situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but he believes that this demands urgent attention and swift action.
I would think this is also going to force his hand sooner rather than later in terms of just what he is going to do about the troop pull down out of Iraq, as Robert mentioned. That is a topic that we will have to address when we get together for the next time we have you both on, which I appreciate.
Thank you.
Donna, that was Donna Brazile. Thank she you, is Donna. A Democratic strategist joining us by telephone this time. And Robert George, associate editorial page editor for the New York Post, he joined us from the studios of NPR in New York. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. If you've never heard of Twitter, chances are you will soon. The trend of microblogging is inching closer to the mainstream. Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes. He joins me now to talk about it. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tony.
So what is microblogging and why are more people starting to do it?
Well, it's a form of blogging that allows people to send brief text updates or short messages to other subscribers of that same service. Now, the most popular microblogging site is Twitter. And researchers at the Pew Internet and American Life Project recently conducted a survey about Twitter, and they found, rather unsurprisingly, that American Twitter users are young, active in social media, and highly mobile, they write. And most are between the ages of 18 and 34. And the cool thing is that Twitter is actually advancing the cause of citizen journalism. Earlier in the year, Twitter users, for instance, they sent updates and photos of the U.S. Airways flight landing in the Hudson River well before those same photos and information ended up on mainstream news outlets.
That's interesting. Another popular social networking site, Facebook, made news this week over privacy concerns. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, earlier this month, Facebook changed its terms of service. It's that small print that people usually scroll through and don't read. And a consumer advocacy blog interpreted the changes to mean that Facebook would essentially own whatever people upload to the site, even if one were to close the account. And the company's CEO tried to calm people's fears earlier this week with a blog post, but with a revolt on their hands and really bad publicity, they decided to reverse their changes of service and reinstate their old privacy policies.
All right. So when you go off, you're off.
Exactly.
All right. Yeah. And what are people talking about on our website this week?
Well, we've linked to an article by Spelman College professor William Jelani Cobb. It's a piece titled Confessions of a Reluctant Flag Waver, and he tries to parse what he calls the interconnectedness of black history and American history in light of Barack Obama's presidency. And there's a political cartoon in today's New York Post, which some, including Reverend Al Sharpton, say are racist and a racist spoof of President Obama. So we have that cartoon and some conversation about that.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about that in a minute with our other bloggers. As always, Jeffrey Bennett, great to have you back.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes, joining me from the studios of NPR West. Now on to our bloggers roundtable. Here's what's hot online. Illinois Senator Roland Burris and the ongoing Blagojevich scandal. The stimulus package just signed by the president and the so-called Obama effect and how that's changing the culture of America. With us, Jay Anderson of the blog Average Bro. Self-described vigilante pundit Baratunde Thurston. He writes for Jack and Jill Politics under the pseudonym Jack Turner. And in a moment, we're going to be joined by political and social opinion writer Sophia Nelson. She's editor-in-chief of the Political Intersection blog. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Let's begin with Mr. Burris. As we mentioned earlier in the show, He said that he tried to raise money for former Governor Rod Blagojevich before he was appointed to fill Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat. Let's start with you, Jay. Why is this all over the blogs, and what are people saying?
It's all over the blogs because I'll be honest. I came on this show and I blogged myself about a month ago about the fact that I thought Burris should be seated. The reason for that was at that point in time, Governor Blagojevich, there were no actions taken against him at that point in time. And I felt that he was perfectly within his rights to appoint Burris,
You still feel that way? You still feel that way?
No. And the reason for that, I mean, the Senate was very clear with Burris about what it is that he needed to do to get the seat. Basically, they wanted him to go back to Illinois and be honest about what it is that happened in terms of his interactions with Blagojevich. Well, he didn't do that. You know, now a month or so later, it looks like, you know, Burris, for whatever reason, is coming out and proactively divulging the fact that he didn't put a lot of information out there, that maybe made things look like they weren't on the up and up. You know, that said, he's got to step down. I'm sorry.
All right.
I mean, you have to. When you come into the Senate under those sorts of circumstances under which he did, you know, with the scrutiny that he did, you have to follow the rule of the law. And he didn't do that. He's got
to
go.
Let me bring Baratunde in there to ask you, do you think or what you are seeing and hearing on the blogs, are people saying the same thing as Jay? They want him out? They think he wasn't truthful?
There's definitely a lot of doubt around the man who I'm starting to call Senator. What had happened was Burris.
That's clever.
The idea that he needs to step down is one, you know, point, a popular point, but the minimum is that there is absolutely no chance that he has any chance of getting reelected in 2010 if he's even able to weather this storm. A lot of folks were really skeptical and tried, even the Senate initially, their first instinct was don't trust anything associated with Blagojevich.
Well, you know,
that was the right instinct.
That was an interesting point that you raised. And Sophia, let me put it to you this way. There was concern, as Baratunde just said, about seating him in the first place, but there is an argument that was made that the folks in Illinois and in the Senate felt that it was necessary to put him on because he was black and they didn't want to look like they were racist. And so now that seems to have blown up, doesn't it?
Well, if that was their reason, it was the wrong reason. The lawyer in me, from the moment this happened, was very adamant about the fact that from a constitutional standpoint and from the constitution of the state of Illinois and otherwise, he had a legal right to be seated because he was appointed by a legally sitting governor at the time of the state. And so that was always my point of view. However, in light of these new facts that are coming to light, I'm in agreement with the other gentlemen on this panel today that he has a serious credibility problem now, and I think it just continues to show that politics in Chicago and in the state of Illinois, continue to be what we all know them to be.
And in Washington, D.C. as well.
Let's
talk about the stimulus package, the other big news coming yesterday as the president signed into law the wide-ranging $787 billion economic stimulus package that includes tax cuts and spending programs. So, Jay, a lot of Americans expecting to get checks and tax breaks. Are their expectations too high?
I'm not sure the expectations are too high. I mean, if you look at the news, if you pay any attention to what's going on in the world, I mean, 600,000 people lost jobs in January alone. There's just the government has to do something. And I think people's expectations are that some sort of action is taken. And that's what Obama's doing. Now, you know, whether you agree with all the facets of the Stimulus Act or whether you think there needed to be more tax breaks, you know, versus more spending. I mean, that's immaterial to me at this point. Reality is you have to do something. You know, no act of this magnitude, again, it's almost $800 billion, is going to be perfect. And unfortunately, there are obviously going to be some stumbles as this thing works itself out. But I think Obama had no choice. And again, furthermore, the people who put him in the office wanted something different. And here it is.
So, Baratunde, here's my question for you. The enormity of this stimulus package is unprecedented in American financial history. And I'm wondering whether or not on the blogosphere, particularly the black blogosphere, it's getting the kind of attention and hits that Burris is getting.
I can't speak for the entire black blogosphere, but what I can say is that the stimulus is getting a lot of attention, at least on jackandjoepolitics.com and some of the other peers. People are looking through the state-by-state kind of job retention promises of the bill. And Jay mentioned the unprecedented size of this. I think and the expectations not being so high. But what is also unprecedented is the transparency and attempt at accountability. We've never seen a government, you know, act followed up by a website to track how it's spent. And I'll be most curious to see not if the bill itself was perfect, but rather if the follow-up is as honest and as open as we hope and expect it will be.
Well, Sophia, there's been a lot of talk about the so-called bipartisan effort to get the stimulus package, if you count three Republicans as bipartisan. What political backlash could there be if this bill does work and if it doesn't work? Bipartisan speaking.
Look, there was no bipartisanship on this. And I think, look, I'm a Republican. I support this president. I voted for him, but I don't like this bill at all. And for me, this issue is personal because I was one of those people that got downsized from my corporate America job last summer. Haven't been able to find one since. And, you know, I'm very well educated, very well qualified. And this economy is hitting everybody at every level, not just the poor, not just the middle class, but those of the professional class as well. That's why you're seeing the challenges with the home mortgages, foreclosures. I see it in my neighborhood. Every other house is either up for sale or it's going downhill. And I live in a very nice neighborhood in Northern Virginia suburbs. And my point is that I think Black America is not paying enough attention to this issue on the blogosphere. On my site, I would say I probably have a 50-50 audience of African-American and then other. And we've been talking about it a lot. But as you know, when white America gets a runny nose, Black America gets a cold. You know what I mean? The old expression that it always hits the Black community in disproportionately high numbers. Unemployment, if it's 8% in the U.S. economy, it's going to be 16% in the Black community, in some places as high as 20, 30, 40%, depending on what city you're looking at the time. So I think this is an important issue for the Black community, as it is for America, certainly, but I think that we're not paying enough attention to it in a serious matter, and we're getting too caught up in the pettiness of the politics of, well, the Republicans don't want to support him and Rush Limbaugh doesn't like the president. Who cares what Rush Limbaugh thinks, to be real honest? I don't.
Let me jump in to let our listeners know what we're doing and who we're talking to. This is the Bloggers Roundtable. I'm joined by Jay Anderson of the blog Average Bro, also by Baratunde Thurston, who writes for Jack and Jill Politics under the pseudonym Jack Turner, and political and social opinion writer Sophia Nelson. She's editor-in-chief of the Political Intersection blog. This is good conversation. Let's turn it a little bit to this point. The impact of the presidency of Barack Obama will resonate far beyond the White House, and I want to talk about whether or not the Obama effect, as it is so called, is having an effect on the blogosphere. Do you think that it is changing the role, Baratunde, of Black blogs, or perhaps it already has?
Well, it certainly has. I mean, as far back as a year ago, we certainly started getting more attention and traffic, essentially from, you know, designated media outlets and spokespeople who realized, oh my goodness, we don't know how to talk about Black people. And we're tired of going back to the same old reverend in a tracksuit sort of spokesperson who's been saying the same thing for the past 15
years. Are you talking about
Baratunde? I'm just throwing out examples. I mean, I just throwing out examples.
Okay.
So I think what you had was really, you know, bloggers filling in for a job that the media itself was ill-prepared to handle. And you saw a lot of slip-ups and a lot of ignorance about the race baiting that was going on. So even now, that will continue as folks realize, like, wow, Black people are still here, and they're kind of important.
Well, Jay Anderson, are you getting more hits when you talk about Obama on your blog? You get a larger audience or no?
Oh, yes. I mean, everyone wants to talk politics. And obviously, you know, I don't run a blog that's strictly political. I talk a lot about pop culture as well as sports and an array of other issues. But absolutely. I mean, the Obama, the run up in terms of, you know, the campaign. And now, of course, that he's in office. I mean, people are always looking for alternative opinions that they do not hear in the mainstream media. And I think that's absolutely where the Black blogosphere, you know, comes into play.
So, well, Sophia, are you making any money, though, at it?
I think the opportunities since Barack Obama was inaugurated as president for African Americans who are journalists, pundits, if you will, anyone that can write well, the opportunities are huge. I don't ever lack for people calling me, wanting me on TV shows, whether it's conservative programs or more liberal ones, whether it's writing opportunities, corporate America. I'm speaking a lot more. I think that, is it Baratunde? I want to say his name right.
Baratunde.
By the way, Baratini, I'm in a tracksuit over here, so.
Oh, my goodness. All right, I'm going to ask you what black people do.
I'm teasing. No, no, no.
Do you have a perm, too?
So, it's a pink one, though. No, I'm joking. At any rate, the thing is that he's absolutely right, though, that they, I mean mainstream media, didn't know how to incorporate the opinions of African Americans or the views of, wow, what's it going to be like to have a black president, a black first lady's even more huge. That's mm-hmm. what we get a lot of hits on Political Intersection blog and my companion site, IAskSisterBlog.com, which is an organization for women of color, professional women of color. And the love for Michelle Obama is just, it's unbelievable how she has impacted the way that black women are looked at, for example. And there have been a lot of stories about her, as you know, what she wears, what her hair looks like, all of those things. So black people are, it's the Cosby decade all over again, I think. It's, you know, we are.
Absolutely. You know. Listen, our time is running short, but I want to hit something else that's been coming up. It's about, you talked about images of Michelle mm-hmm. Obama and Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about political cartoons, since you all write a political blog, where prominent people are shown in caricature. Now, with Obama, this presents some touchy questions. And already, mm-hmm. a cartoon this week in the New York Post is drawing criticism from that guy in the jumpsuit because it shows a monkey, which could be presumed to be the president. The Post, of course, saying that that's absurd. But you see my point, Baratunde.
I absolutely do. And here's the problem with this particular image. The history of, you know, comparing black people to primates is vile and deep and real. Mm. And it leads to actual practiced discrimination and violence. You see police brutality, you see discrimination. A lot of that is based in these subconscious painful images. And the reasonable interpretation of this cartoon is just what it is, that you've got a dead at the hands of police monkey who is a stand-in for the president of the United States. Jeez. That's unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to point, there's a summit on February 26th, cple.psych.ucla.edu. It's people trying to study just this phenomena, how the psychological, you know, demands of racism, you know, become real in acts of police brutality and violence.
Well, I think If I can just interject quickly, this culture, you know, we voted for a black man to be president, but it did not deal with the underlying causes of racism, mm-hmm. of prejudice that this country has had since its founding. And we're still not talking about it. We're talking around it. We're in love with the pop culture images, but we're not dealing with the realities of a country's psychological shift from seeing 43 white men be president to now the 44th being a black man. Black family, black little girls running around, a dog is going to be in the White House soon. That's a culture shock to people.
It is. I've got to stop you there only because our time is short. I appreciate all of you. We've been talking with Baratunde Thurston, who blogs at the Huffington Post and Jack and Jill Politics. He was at our NPR studios in New York. Jay Anderson of the blog Average Bro, he was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. And political and social opinion writer Sophia Nelson. She's editor-in-chief of the Political Intersection blog and was at member station WETA in Arlington, Virginia. And of course, you can find links to their blog as well as to ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. Thanks, everybody. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. What do you like to be called? And how do you feel when someone addresses you in a way that you think is improper or unbefitting your age or your status? The question of what's in a name and how and when titles should be used is something we've heard a lot about since Barack Obama was elected president. Or should it be Mr. Barack Obama or Mr. President Barack Obama? Listen to this exchange I had with a former L.A. Superior Court judge last week.
This whole point about Barack's name, the president's name, right now, it doesn't matter what you call him. Folks are hurting and they need jobs. And if we're not able to address that on a level that people can relate to, they're going to be calling him more than just what we're referring to right now.
Those remarks were by Kevin Ross, and they generated a lot of discussion. We're going to hear from Kevin again in just a moment. But first, we're going to address the issue of how to address our elders, our parents, our superiors with NPR correspondent Karen Grigsby Bates. She is also co-author of the book Basic Black, Home Training for Modern Times, and she blogs on etiquette manners at theroot.com. Welcome to News and Notes, Karen Grigsby Bates.
Thank you, Tony. It's nice to be back here. I think I can call you Tony because yes, we're friends can. And you're not the president.
All right. Well, and that's one of the points of the protocol for addressing people, what your relationship is to them. So lay it out for us. What's the rule about being on a first-name basis with people, especially if they are leaders or superiors?
I think for leaders or superiors, they're human beings, but they're also the embodiment of the office they represent. And so when I hear people referring to the president as Barack, excuse me, Judge Ross, it makes me a little bit nervous because he is the president. He's the president of the United States. I know that as black folks, we like to consider him our own personal president, and he is, but he's still the president of the United States. Everybody, people elected him. He sort of owed that due. And there's the respect for the office, even if we're comfortable slipping into first name basis.
This goes much farther than just Barack Obama as president, doesn't it? In terms of within our culture and others, how we address one another properly and improperly.
It does, and I think it goes way, way back to how we were addressed when we were owned by other people, and immediately after that, when we were considered less than the then majority population. It was considered perfectly proper in many parts of the country for someone to be Mr. Jones and for Mr. Jones to be able to call you Tony, even if you were older than he, if you were black and he wasn't. That still stings. And I think that as black folks in general, for generations, we have been very, very careful to use these honorifics because for so long we were denied them.
But that's not happening now, is it?
It is in many places.
And it's not in many places, too.
Yeah, and part of that, I think, is generational. You know, the farther you get from that kind of old school home training that says, this is not Susan, this is Aunt Susan, or this is Mrs. Cox, depending on how she prefers to be called and how intimate your child's relationship is with her, for instance, that you get people who sort of feel like, oh, that's so old-timey, we don't need to be bothered. Think again.
Well, let's bring Kevin into the conversation. And Kevin's been a good sport about this. We played that clip a couple of times. Kevin, I want to ask you about when you were on the bench as a Superior Court judge. What would you do if someone were to call you Kevin and not Your Honor?
Well, thank you for having me, Tony and Karen. It's always a pleasure. What's interesting, when I first became a judge, people immediately started referring to me as Judge Ross even before I took the oath of office and even before I actually assumed the position. And then as time went on, it seemed very weird to me. It was the same sort of feeling when people would refer to my wife by my last name as opposed to her last name. And there was that transition period where, oh, yeah, that's right, she is Mrs. Ross. Because up until that point, the only Mrs. Ross that I knew was my mother. So, you know, I went through this phase of people referring to me as Judge Ross, and then for a time, I would correct them and say, no, no, it's just Kevin, it's fine. But then I had a situation where I had sentenced a defendant to, you know, a pretty good amount of jail time, and I was at Costco with my family, and because I am from the Los Angeles area, I grew up with a lot of folks here, and while I was in Costco, I was walking away, and someone went, Kevin, hey, what's going on? And so I looked and I thought, oh, well, maybe this is someone who knows me or someone I grew up with. And I said, do I know you? And they were like, yeah, I was in court. And I was like, you're not the defendant that I sentenced, are you? And the person said, yeah, Kev, how you doing? And I was like, oh, no, my brother.
Yeah, the line had been crossed. Well, you know what, Kevin, you're calling the president by his first name, and your explanation got some of our listeners hot under the collar, as we've said. Politics aside, though, do you still think it's okay to call him Barack? And if you do, why?
Well, here's what I find interesting. This is day 28 of when he was officially inaugurated into office. And so from January 20th until today, we've had 28 days of getting used to the notion of President Obama. And my point was very similar to what I was saying about my wife. We are in a transition mode. If you look at Michelle Obama, our First Lady Obama, getting used to that as well. When she spoke before the Housing and Urban Development Office, here's some of the things that she said. Barack and I and all the folks in the West Wing and the East Wing were very proud of what you've done for the country. She went on to say, Barack and I always believe that investing in the community that you live in is first and foremost very critical. So here you have the First Lady even addressing our Commander-in-Chief by his first name.
Yeah, but that's a different circumstance.
No, here's the point, though. When you listen to Laura Bush, our First Lady, refer to her husband, she never said George. She always said the President or Mr. President or President Bush because she had gotten accustomed to using that title.
Well, let me bring Karen back in to ask her this question, because what you raise is something that perhaps we can provide a service for our listeners who are wondering what in the world they should do when they're confronted with circumstances like this. So what do you say, Karen, to the person who has, as they say, called you out of your name? And more importantly, how do you correct them?
Well, you know, I like the Sidney Poitier approach. He counseled somebody who was calling him out of his name. He said, they call me Mr. Tibbs.
Yes, I love that.
And I think it's okay to say, to a child, Sandy, in our house, we call the adults Mr. and Mrs. Or it's okay to say to, I don't know, somebody that's just met you that you're referring to as Mr. and Mrs., and they're calling you by your first name, and you don't know if you'll ever see them again. Actually, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable with that informality. How about we call each other whatever? And usually people get the hint pretty
quickly. I actually had this circumstance happen to me yesterday because, as you know, I'm an associate professor at California State University, and one of my students who was older and who I had a relationship with outside of the university, who's in my class, called me Tony in class one time. And I had the opportunity to talk to him in the hallway, and I said, look, you and I have a relationship, but don't call me Tony in class.
See, because there's this presumption of the fact that you all are equals when sometimes that's not the case, that there's a differentiation because of age, for instance, so that you wouldn't, I mean, your student was an older student, and so he was presuming you were equals because you were about the same age, yeah. But he's breaking down your lines of authority in class. When children in the fifth grade call their teacher Hilda, that's a problem for me.
This is true. And this guy we were friends, but I didn't want to put him down because it wasn't that.
You did the right thing. You took him aside. You didn't embarrass him.
And I agree. Listen, I am very formal. I have two kids. One's, you know, both under the age of 12, and their little friends, you know, 6 through 10, will come and say, well, Kevin? And I was like, Kevin? I said, oh, no. Jordan and them and my kids, I said, their dad is named Mr. Ross. So it's interesting that I find myself even in the situation of, you know, I'm around the same age as the president. We're married around the same number of years. We have kids the same age. We were in law school at the same time. So I've never met the president, and yet I do feel a certain amount of familiarity. But I think what we're getting ready to see is as time goes on, for the very reason that Karen said, we as African Americans are very hypersensitive to this issue. But I think 6 months from now, a year from now, anyone who's still referring to the president as just Barack or Obama, I think that's when we start looking at it and going, okay, you've had enough time to get used to the name.
Absolutely. Our time has run out, but this has been a really good conversation. We didn't get to talk about the good Reverend Doctor in church, which is another title that black folks have issues with sometimes.
Sometimes,
Karen.
We like our multiple honorifics all piled up on
absolutely.
Each other.
Absolutely. And people that get PhDs wanting to be referred to as doctors. NPR's policy, by the way, on something like that is we don't refer to doctors on the air generally unless they are medical doctors.
Interestingly enough, with black shows, sometimes we do because of the culture.
Well, I guess you got that right. I appreciate you coming on. This was Karen Grigsby Bates. She's also a NPR correspondent and an author and writes at TheRoot.com. And Kevin Ross, I appreciate you all, Mr. and Mrs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Slavery in America is a well-documented era in our country, but what are the stories of the children of the slaves? What is this generation's legacy? Newsweek's special correspondent Sana Butler sought to find and to document their lives in her book Sugar of the Crop, My Journey to Find the Children of the Slaves. I began by asking her about her great-grandmother's funeral and how that started her on her journey.
I thought my family was the exception to the rule. When you talk about the years following slavery, you think of hostility and anger based on the people's experience. And my family raised us with love, and I thought that was not the the traditional route with a lot of the histories, again, coming out of slavery. And when I started finding the people, I found that it was absolutely amazing that what I found was that the people I interviewed were not unlike my family, and that what the people raised their children with the same kind of unconditional love.
Now, I would imagine that most of these interviews took place in the South, and that most of these people were either octogenarians or something older at the time that you talked to them, were they?
Mm-hmm. Let's try centenarians.
Centenarians.
The oldest person I interviewed was 112, and I think the youngest was 86, a man named Crispus Attucks Wright in California. The 112-year-old I was not able to include because she did not have all of her faculties. She didn't remember much about her family or her years as well. You know, didn't really remember much about yesterday.
Now, let me ask. I would think, Sana, that you've already mentioned that you were surprised that a number of these people were not angry or did not harbor bitterness about having been born to parents who were slaves. But what else was it about them, if there was a thread that seemed to tie them together?
Their parents raised them with hope. The idea that I want your life to be better than mine. And though things aren't the way we were promised, right, with emancipation, things aren't the way they were promised, that one day they will be, and you'll be ready for it.
You also describe them in the book as having immigrant-like expectations. Explain what you meant.
There was this genuine commitment to want to believe in the future, which is phenomenal to think about. There was this belief that everything that happened to me is over, the worst is behind after the Civil War, and I am going to go out and seek a new life in freedom, right? Mm-hmm. So everything, all of my hopes and dreams, I am going to give that back to the country. There was a genuine commitment to reinvest in the building of what was to be a new America.
Was it a patriotism?
It was. They truly believed that they were Americans and they wanted to participate. There was a social and political momentum in the years following the Civil War that has yet to be matched. And the level at which freed slaves voted, ran for office, were elected into office, those rates have never since been seen.
Who stood out for you, and what was it about their story that touched you?
Gosh, I felt all the stories touched me, really, and I know it sounds generic and cliche, but there were epiphany moments in every single interview. But I do think the one that stood out the most was, you know, was Mr. Hood. He was my very, very last interview. And from him, I got the name of the chapter. But more importantly, he stopped talking 2 days after I left and died 3 days later. And there was this need to want to tell his story, to want to tell his story of his family. And the story of his family, his father was a slave born in South Carolina and was auctioned away along with his brothers and sisters. But they all made a pact to get back together after the war ended. And it just, and a lot of them missed their lives. And, you know, the story of African Americans coming out of slavery is such that slavery is the root cause of the breakdown of the African American families. And that's, you know, historians and scholars say that. But to hear Mr. Hood tell it, it's a completely different angle.
Now, you mentioned Sugar of the Crop, which is the title of the book, and I believe that's the one that came from Mr. Hood, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell our audience what that meant, because I thought that was really fascinating.
Oh, it brings tears to my eyes just to think about it. Mr. Hood said that Mr. Hood had three sons and one daughter. His father was, again, a slave born in South Carolina named Reverend John. And his father, Mr. Hood's father, Reverend John, used to call the only granddaughter he had Shug. And when I asked Mr. Hood what Shug meant, he said, my father called her Sugar because she was the sweetest out of the whole family. So he called her Sugar with a Crop. And that's what this generation was, the first free generation of African Americans raised by freed slaves. It's the sweetest out of the community of African Americans. That's who we are.
Sana, thank you.
My pleasure, Tony.
That was Sana Butler. She is a special correspondent at Newsweek International. Her book is Sugar of the Crop, My Journey to Find the Children of Slaves. She joined us from the NPR studios in New York.